Hi, this is Joan Renner from Deranged LA Crimes in Los Angeles, California, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to the fabulous old Ice House, a classic old building here in Midtown Kansas City within blocks of many mob hits over the years. I'm here in the studio with my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, folks, tonight we have one more in our ongoing series, The Media and the Mob. This week we're going back east to Boston, and we have on the line Emily Sweeney from the Boston Globe. Hello, Emily. Good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Hey, Gary. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, thanks for being here.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. This has been a fun series. We had an old-timer bulldog, John Drummond from Chicago. Boy, did he have some stories. As you can well imagine, he started in the 50s and just recently retired from it. We had a guy from Kansas City who actually, you know, I used to be in the Organized Crime and Intelligence Unit in Kansas City, and I used to slip this guy a few tips every now and then, and we became friends over the years. He would maybe, if I needed to know something or a picture that they had, he would get that for me. And we had him on. He had some pretty good stories. He had a really good story about our local mob boss. They wanted to subpoena the records of the Kansas City Star because what they wanted to do, we wanted to find out who on the strike force and the FBI was leaking information to them. They were sure that somebody was leaking information to them as they were getting ready to go into a big trial. And so they called Bill up on the stand, and their attorney, I think it might have been Oscar Goodman, actually, their attorney, you know, ask him who his sources were and, you know, why he was reporting all these bad things about his clients. And then they asked the judge to order him to reveal his sources. And then they broke for lunch. And Mel said that was the longest or maybe the shortest lunch he ever had. He didn't know when he came back if he's going to be ordered to reveal his sources or go to jail or what was going to happen. Now he got back and the First Amendment went out and the judge did not order him to reveal his sources. It was really, everybody understood what it was, just kind of a delaying tactic and blowing smoke tactic as they got ready to go to trial. But anyhow, lawyers trying to earn their money. So
they always do.
Yeah. So anyhow, in Boston, tell us a little bit about your history. How did you get to become a reporter, Emily?
Well, you know, I went to Northeastern University to play hockey, and I was started out as a science major, and the science lab started getting in the way of my hockey practice, honestly, and I decided to try to find like the most flexible major, and it was journalism, and you know, I have no regrets. When I went into it, I thought it was great because I was figured, hey, I could write about science, I can write about hockey, I can write about all types of stuff. And I'm a huge history buff. And so throughout my journalism career, which is going back, almost 20 years now, I've done a lot of research and just like looking into the history of things. And that's how I kind of got into reporting on organized crime in this area.
Well, interesting. You guys have, Boston has quite a history, a recent history, or at least a lot of recent headlines. I'm not so sure about what the status of the mob is in Boston today and the New England mob, which historically seemed like the boss was Raymond Patriarca, who actually operated out of Providence, Rhode Island. But you know, you have quite a rich history of that with the Irish factions or the Irish mobs themselves and the Italian La Cosa Nostra mobs. How did you just get attracted to that, or did you get assigned to that kind of reporting early on?
Yeah, well, so there's a little hamlet called Brookline right next to Boston. And about 17 years ago, I was a reporter for the Brookline Cab. And it's like this little affluent suburb, again, nestled right next to Boston. Tom Brady lives there now in Brookline.
Yeah, very affluent then, and, huh?
Yes, quite. And it's also a mix, you know. You also have like a working class part of Brookline. And anyway, when I was a reporter there, I started like looking up and just like seeing like all the different mob connections to Brookline. I ended up doing like this big cover story on just all the different ways the mob was connected to Brookline. A lot of mobsters made their homes in Brookline. You know, legendary bookmaker Doc Sagansky, he lived in Brookline for years and years. Legendary gangsters like King Solomon made his home in Brookline. So, you know, connecting all those dots led to a big cover story, and readers loved it, you know, and just kind of seeing like all the different ways mobsters, you know, lived, worked, played, whatever, in Brookline. That story led to my first book titled Boston Organized Crime, which came out in 2012. Many years later, after I left the Brookline Tab. And what that was a compilation of mugshots, many of which had never been published before, of crime scenes, lots of mugshots, and just all these, you know, photos that I got from the FBI, state police, and different police sources over the years. Yeah. And now my latest book, Gangland Boston, is kind of a sequel to that, and where I expand on, you know, the history of organized crime in the greater Boston area, going all the way back to like the 1890s. I was surprised to learn that the mafia had a foothold, or at least, you know, that's what newspapers were reporting at the time, going back, you know, way back when.
Getting those, I'm always interested in, of course, and this is about the media reporting on the mob and your experiences there. So how hard was it for you to get a lot of those? Did you get some good crime scene photos, and how hard was it for you to get those? The crime scene photos are kind of hard to get sometimes.
Oh, wicked, wicked hard to get. Believe me, I ran into so many walls, I can't even tell you. And, you know, when you file a Freedom of Information Act request with, like, you know, the FBI, I don't know, I'm sure you know, like, it can take a really long time. But I got to say, patience won out. I did get a lot of good stuff from the FBI. And also, I had some excellent police sources who really, like, literally opened up, like, you know, dusty old files, and we would go through them together. And, like, you know, they hadn't been looked at in years and years. I lucked out in that regard, having some good relationships in the police departments. One police department literally, like, gave me a chair, set all the files in front of me, and I just spent, like, afternoon after afternoon there, you know, going through everything and found some really good stuff. So that's where, I mean, relationships are key, you know what I mean, especially in this business, working in the media.
Said I got to know this local reporter, Bill Norton. I kind of like up through the chain of command. I'd always said, you know, he's a good guy. He's a square shooter. He's not going to hurt you. And when our upper management was ready to release a big mob story, they allowed him to come into the intelligence unit. Unheard of before. Unheard of. Let him have a chair and a desk, and just brought him the old files back, because he was going to do a history to start off with the early 50s and just before the skim trials, the skimming out of Las Vegas. It was what was in the movie Casino, started in Kansas City, and they wanted to bring the current family, or the family that was family head at that time, from the 1950s when he first took over all the way up to present day. I couldn't believe that they did it. I'm kind of a young trooper then, so.
Wow. Now that's impressive. Seriously. One thing I know, like, I gotta say, I gotta give props to my sources, like, for this new book, Gangland Boston. I talked to one retired DEA agent. I mean, he had some incredible stories of how, like, they bugged Whitey Bulger's car. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They had to, like, take out the visor, you know, in his car, and then replace it with an exact, like, replica with the bug inside, and doing that undetected. I mean, it's pretty incredible. And also, like, told me stories of, like, them, like, you know, just trying to get anything on him. Like, they would bug, like, mailboxes. And this one mailbox that they bugged, it was in front of a deli, right? Yeah, they are. They're, like, monitoring the bug. They're, you know, drug dealers or alleged drug dealers are hanging out around this mailbox. And what do you know, this is a rowdy crew. One of the guys, like, drop kicks, karate kicks the mailbox. Okay, so like, the sound goes dead. So, you know, the bug that had been secreted, you know what I mean? Like, you know, yeah. Tucked away in the mailbox, comes down. When the mailman goes to, you know, take out the letters, the mail, he sees this electronic device, thinks it's a bomb, calls in the
oh, no, he called the police.
He got the freaking bomb squad in there.
Oh,
like,
no.
And everyone's, what the hell is this? They worked hard during surveillance, I got to tell you. And, you know, some of those stories he told me were incredible. And he was so kind. He even gave me, like, I mean, a whole disc of photos that him and his colleagues took while doing surveillance on Bulger and his cohorts. So pretty wild stuff.
Yeah, those are good surveillance photos. Those are like gold. You know, we didn't back in the day when I was doing it. And even after that, we didn't really keep them. We kept them for a little bit. And then, you know, a few years later, they would end up getting purged because whoever it was, you know, they were dead or, you know, they'd moved on or they were in jail for a long time and they didn't really keep much historical stuff like that.
Or in the case of Whitey Bulger, he'd moved to California.
Yeah, Whitey moved.
Oh, yeah.
For the movie deal to come through, right?
Yeah, was he out there to get a movie deal?
I know, right?
I want to know when Whitey's book's coming out. A lot of these guys have been writing books in the last few years. Wonder when Whitey's book will come out.
Wow. I can tell you, that would be a bestseller.
Would be a horror novel bestseller.
Seriously. It's interesting seeing all the people. I mean, he's written back to, I wrote him in prison, and alas, I never heard back from him. He has, like, responded to, there's a group of, I don't know if they were high school students or junior high school students. Anyway, school students who had written him for a school assignment, he ended up writing them back. You know what I mean? Telling them to, like, you know, stay out of trouble. Like, you know, giving some, like, you know, grandfatherly advice. He has been doing a lot of writing, you know, while he's been behind bars, that's for sure.
Well, I was going to ask you, with the development of the books, you're talking about Boston as a metropolitan city, so you have, you know, like the Brookline Police, and you probably have Boston proper police, but there's all these different, aren't these different jurisdictions across the metro, so you really have to have a relationship with all these different police departments.
Yeah, it comes in really handy. Different police departments, and also the state police, and also the even the attorney general's office is really good, you know, with that, helping me out. Not with photos, but, like, you know, transcripts and whatnot, you know, from cases of long ago. You know, in this book, again, it's kind of a historical perspective, like a historic tour through the city. I try to use stories that haven't been told as much or haven't been reported as much or, you know, at all since they happened. One kind of interesting story that is from, again, it's from like the 1930s, but there's a really prominent gangster named Samuel Windenbaum. He was a boxer when he was younger, started getting into trouble. And when there was this one time he apparently held up a store with a buddy and a couple girls. So the girls got in trouble too when they got picked up. And so he told the police, I dressed up in a wig, in a dress, and I did it. You know what I mean? The police had a field day with Windenbaum, and from then on, in all the newspapers, they called him the Bobtailed Bandit. You know, which, I mean, it was kind of clear. I don't know, reading between the lines, it sounds like, you know, the guy was trying to cover for his girlfriend, but yeah. The police wouldn't let that one go. So.
I love reading those older newspaper articles and the headlines they used to come up with. They were pretty colorful writers, a lot more colorful than you are today. You can get by with a lot
more. Yes, I think they had a lot more leeway back then. I don't know whether that's for good or bad, but
really,
the readers, sure, I'm sure, got a kick out of it.
I don't know if the Boston Globe or the Kansas City Star, the Washington Post, or the New York Times, if they come up with nicknames for mobsters today. Somehow I doubt it, but they came up with a lot of them back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, I mean, I got to say, the Bobtail Bandit, that's one. Pretty unique for that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've definitely had our share of different characters who go under different nicknames. But that's one thing I always wish, you know, I could have so many I wish I could go back in time and have face-to-face interviews with some of these guys who had these nicknames. And I'm like, dude, what did you really think about that?
Really?
You know what I mean? Because even Whitey Bulger, I mean, in every account that I know of, I mean, he always just went by Jimmy. You know what I mean? Nobody ever, like, you know, said, hey, Whitey, to his face. I mean, not, like, you know, during his adult life, but...
Or nobody that lived.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right?
Now, so then how did you jump from being in the... you said that was the Brookline Cab was the paper that you started at, and then you're now at the Boston Globe, but where did you go between... from one to the other?
Yeah, well, so from the Brookline Tab, I made a short stop at the Waltham Daily News Tribune, and that's a city right outside of Boston. You know, that cover story I did about all the Brookline mob connections, that kind of caught the eye of a couple editors at the Globe. And so when I was hired at the Globe in 2001, one of the first things they wanted me to do was, hey, can you do like a mob tour of Boston for the paper and for online, put that together. And yeah, so, I mean, again, kind of the organized crime and just like doing the research and looking into the history of it has carried, you know, I've carried that with me. And the Globe Archives, talk about a tremendous resource. You know, all the librarians are so helpful and, you know, and so accommodating, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, whenever I had a free chance, I'd always be like going down to the library and like looking through the folders and, you know what I mean? Just like trying to dig up any photos and like, hey, can I make a copy of this? Can I use this? They've always been really good to me. So I really appreciate that. I've been lucky.
Are your articles scanned in and then can you keyword search your old Boston Globe articles? That's a huge help.
Online.
I go on newspapers.com and can find just some of the most amazing things and even a lot of little town newspapers.
Yeah. So I write so many stories now that you keyed my work, my name into the quote, a zillion different stories would come up. I do have a website and a Facebook page that where I post a lot of, like, I stick with the organized crime stuff. The website's www.bostonorganizedcrime.com. The Facebook page is same thing. It's like facebook.com/bostonorganizedcrime. What I've been doing on the Facebook page, especially, I've been, like, posting photos of, like, houses or hangouts where like mobsters used to hang out right next to their picture. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just give a little, like, say the address, and a lot of people get a kick out of it. And, you know, even sometimes I can see, I mean, you know, sometimes the last names match up, you know, it's like, oh, hey, a relative of, you know what I mean? So-and-so. Like this post. Great.
Yeah, really.
So,
I mean, when you put together a walking tour and online kind of, you know, Gary has an app that he developed called the Kansas City Mob Tour. And there was, you know, every time we would do an episode, as we started doing this, there'd just be, you know, more information, more addresses to put in there. And, you know, so when you talk about this in Boston, and here you are putting people's home addresses in, I mean, you're not worried about that. I know I could tell you a story of Gary having somebody who downloaded the app and walked up to the house of one of these people in Kansas City.
Yeah, and he got out and with his camera and was walking around to take pictures, and somebody came out and confronted him, and somehow, I don't know, I mean, it didn't go too far downhill. He got on out of there. But
it came back to
Gary.
Yeah,
no kidding.
Gary decided maybe it wasn't so smart to put a physical address.
Yeah, I took that address out, that one there, because family members were still living there. I really didn't want people getting out and walking up there. It's not fair to them, I don't think. But
you're not so worried about that?
Yeah. Well, you know what? Well, now you got me worried. Thanks, guys. No, just kidding. No. I mean, that's a real concern. So the book just came out on the 19th of October. So it's just been a few days out. And the Facebook page, I've been careful. You know what I mean? Like, I've only done like a few homes where it's not like people, I don't know, like homes where you can see you very clearly from, people aren't going to be wandering down like a, you know, a path or a driveway or, you know what I mean?
Right. You're in the city.
Common streets.
Yeah.
You just walk by in the street. These are big suburban houses. And so this guy was walking out through the yards, going around back. And so it's a little bit different.
Well, but are you talking about in Boston, maybe some of the history where it's locations that aren't really anybody current? Or if they were family, you know, from the 30s, the 20s, the 10s.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the book, there are some, for instance, Jerry Angiulo's home in Nahant is still owned by his family. It's just really, I mean, again, it's no secret that he owns it either. And if you're from anywhere around here, you know, I mean, huge oceanfront, gorgeous, gorgeous property. I want to include that in there, though, because it was one thing that caught me was, you know, looking up the home addresses of some really prominent crime figures, you know, from back in the day. I was amazed at how, you know, modest, very modest, a lot of their homes were. I mean, they're very, you know, little bungalow and like, you know, lived there with their parents. Like these, and again, I'm not speaking for everybody, but I mean, a lot of the guys in the book really, really modest holdings. Other guys have definitely had more, you know, a lot more property, like, you know, Jerry Angiulo. And so I included his home in there because it's kind of like an open secret, number one, and just to kind of show, you know, the differences between some of the guys. But no, you raise a really good, I don't know, it might be ethical conundrum, but I haven't run into any problems yet, and I'm knocking on wood right now. So.
Well, I have a suggestion. You can make a little bit of money, not a lot, but you can make a little bit of money by creating an app and then letting people know in Boston that all they have to do is download your app for $1.99 and they can take their own mob tour. It'll be, I promise you, it will be immensely successful. If you just get any kind of word out at all, you'll be able to make a little bit of money off of it. You'll do better than I did.
In Boston,
because it's such a huge population center out there.
Well, and actually, Gary has a friend that he helped. They've kind of developed a walking tour down by the River Market here in Kansas City, and an element of the history of Kansas City, and of course the some of those mob connections.
Wow. Yeah, no, I would. That sounds like that's a phenomenal idea. Seriously, I'm going to have to pay you a commission, Gary. I mean,
I'll send you the information on this. It's really interesting.
Yeah, please do. Because I was going to say, I set up like a Google map of a lot of the locations. It's on my website, bostonareascrime.com. But the Google map, it's too bad because like on a desktop, it looks pretty good. You know what I mean? You click on, I divided everything into like, you know, there's a little like emblem of a house, you know, that's where the mobster lived, you know, or like a gun. This is where a shooting happened. I got it all broken down. But on the phone, it doesn't work very well. I don't know why, but the Google Maps, like the pictures don't pop up easily.
Yeah, I understand.
So it's best viewed on the desktop. If anybody listening wants to check out my website, don't check it out on your phone. Try the desktop first. But yeah, that's a really good idea. Seriously, about the app, I would definitely be interested to hear more about that.
Explain to me kind of the nexus of the Irish mob and the Italian La Cosa Nostra mob.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm painting with a broad brush here. So the current state of the mob is nothing like it used to be. Safe to say, during its prime, let's say, you know, during the major like gang wars of like the 60s, sometimes they'll even say like Irish mob wars, you know, references to that. It wasn't all Irish. You had a lot of different people involved from a lot of different ethnicities. You had like there were like the McLaughlins from Charlestown. Clearly, they're Irish, but you know, also Whitey Bulger, I mean, his partner, and you know, in crime was Stephen Fleming. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so, you know what I mean? They straddled the line of like, there was a lot of loose organizations of criminals in Boston during the 60s. Not a lot, but I should say like a few major ones. You know, that's really how the gang wars came about. There was a couple, you know, surprising things that, you know, I turned up in just doing the research about things. You know, obviously Patriarca was in, you know, did business with the Angiulos. And the one thing that's interesting is Patriarca's alleged involvement with a racetrack out in Western Mass that ultimately ended up failing, Berkshire Downs. One of the investors of Berkshire Downs was none other than Frank Sinatra. That was a subject of a, you know, congressional hearing where Mr. Sinatra was none too pleased
to
testify before. So that was really interesting to, like, you know, hear about the history there. And the track is still there. It's not operating, but it's like a horse farm now. And the woman who owns it, Carol Sebring, she was good enough to provide me with like photos of what it looks like now. You know what I mean? It was kind of did the side by side.
Yeah.
You know, then and now in the book. Yeah. And another thing, I know I'm hopping around a bit, but that I dug up from doing research about crime rings and, or the big, you know, big organization in Boston. When you go even further back, there was a divide between the Italians of the North End and then the Irish of South Boston. And in that area of Boston during Prohibition, the Gustin gang was kind of one rival group to the mafia at the time. And the Gustin gang of South Boston, one of the brothers who were the leaders of the gang, it turns out, was actually went to the Olympics for boxing in 1920, which I thought was kind of neat. This was when in his younger days, and went to Antwerp. You know, made the Team USA boxing squad, you know, had dreams of going pro, dreams of winning a medal when he was over there. And then when he got there, he ended up not even competing. They had him sit as an alternate. And then when he got back from the Olympics, kind of when he started a bigger downward spiral and began drinking more and getting into more trouble with the law, I thought it was kind of incredible. Like, wow, an Olympic athlete was like the leader of, you know what I mean? One of the biggest mobs during the Prohibition years in Boston. It was pretty interesting to find out.
So then during Prohibition, I have to assume that there was a mafia, Italian, La Cosa Nostra, Sicilian-based mafia.
Oh, yeah.
Going on, too, kind of parallel to the Irish. You know, we didn't really have that in Kansas City, and we did a series on the Irish in New York City, and that their kind of conflicts with the Italians, and kind of they go along parallel for a while. And in New York, the Italians eventually just took over everything. I don't think that happened in Boston, did it?
Well, you know, the Italians definitely took the helm early on. So the Gustin gang. You know, they did their thing during Prohibition, running parallel with the Italians in the North End. In 1931, it's exactly unclear whether, like, maybe one of the Gustins hijacked a truck that, or something that was controlled by the Italians. But anyway, one of the Gustin brothers, Frank Wallace is his real name, got called over to a meeting in the North End. And so him and two of his associates showed up to the meeting. You know, probably he thought he was going to lay down the law or maybe at least hammer out a deal where, like, the Italians and the Irish would split profits somehow. And he ended up getting ambushed. And that, from that point on in 1931, the Italians definitely flexed their muscles. And by knocking out one of the main leaders of the Gustin gang, they definitely showed their power and held it for quite a while. You know, in the Boston area.
Interesting. So. It seemed like the Irish would have had the most political, the strongest political base. It appears to me, but I'm not sure. I know, like Whitey's brother was a big time Massachusetts politician.
Yeah. Well, also too the it's interesting, one of the most powerful like politicians in our country, John McCormick, who was the Speaker of the House of Representatives in Congress for many, many years. He actually was a lawyer for one of the Gustin brothers.
Oh, really?
when they got into trouble, yeah. And, you know, I spoke with a professor who wrote, like, a huge biography recently of McCormick. And we're both talking, like, how could they be, like, tied in together? You know, South Boston is a very, was a very tight-knit neighborhood. That was another kind of just incredible thing that me and the professor both marveled at. We're like, we can't believe, you know, this up-and-coming politician represented, you know what I mean? Stevie Gustin, like in district court. and it didn't stop him from going on to bigger and greater things. But it also shows, too, how powerful the Gustins were. You know, it was a whole faction of folks. It's really interesting, too. A lot of people in South Boston at the time, I mean, there was a lot of clashes with the police. I also include in the book just, you know, some, you know, instances of, like, you know, police officers just getting attacked. I mean, just these wild things that you wouldn't think of happening, you know, today. And there was a lot of tension between the police and, I think, you know, common folks at the time. One of the Wallace kids said, like, hey, you know, the police are beating us up, you know, and they very well could have. Yeah. There were times where Steve Gustin showed up in court and his, you know, his mouth, like he's bleeding. He clearly looks roughed up. A lot of people rallied around to protect the kids, like even though they were troublemakers. So it's this interesting dynamic that, you know, again, I tried to capture in the book. But yeah, it was definitely a wild time, that's for sure.
Yeah, I've never been there, but what I've heard and read a little bit about that South Boston, it is a... shall we say an insular neighborhood? It is almost like a country unto itself in some ways.
Yeah, you know, I think the same could be, and again, this is like that. So when I say South Boston, just in recent years, South Boston has changed a lot. But the South Boston that I knew in the 1980s growing up, yes, even going into like the 90s, very insular, very, and you could say the same of the north end of Boston where, you know, the Italians have made their home for, gosh, almost like a century now. Both neighborhoods were very insular. Same with Charlestown, too. Again, that's a, you know, predominantly Irish neighborhood. It's interesting, though, because now South Boston has changed so much. It's 20, 30, 40 years ago, you'd go down South Boston and streets and see, like, kids playing, families. I mean, now it's a lot of just, like, condominiums. All the properties are worth like a million plus. There's all these fancy restaurants and cafes.
Yeah.
It's really wild. Yeah, it's not the selfie of yore.
Yeah, the common,
you know, the changes have happened really fast.
Yeah, the common folk get gentrified out, don't they?
Yep.
It happens in every city. Interesting. Yep. Go ahead, Aaron.
I was going to ask, though, so, I mean, with this kind of division between the north and the south sides of Boston, did they tend to, the police tend to kind of line up in the department based on the side of the city they work? So a lot more Irish cops in the south than Italian, a lot more Italian cops in the north?
Yeah. I mean, you could definitely see, well, for one thing, especially, I mean, from the turn of the century on, there are a lot of Irish police officers. I mean, there are a ton, you know, and right around the turn of the century, there were a lot that were, you know, had been born in Ireland. In the north end, you know, the Italian neighborhoods, they definitely had, like, you know, they placed Italian officers, you know, which, you know, obviously was extremely important at the time, language barriers and whatnot. So, yeah, but I mean, that's another thing that kind of surprised me, just like looking at how Irish the police force was, like going really way back. But yeah, they did try. I mean, being a police officer back then, I can't even imagine because, you know, I mean, they didn't, you know, nobody carried photo IDs. So, I mean, aliases, like everybody just, you know, if you got picked up by the police, you know, people were giving different names all the time, different addresses. They had the Boston Police Department's rogues gallery, you know, of mugshots was still like a work in progress in the 1900s. And then you add in people are driving automobiles and they don't even know how what they're doing. Like, it must have been a wild, wild time, and it must have been extremely difficult to be a police officer back then. You know, the Gustin gang became like a big target, or at least it was stated in the press that way. The Gustins, one thing in my book is like I printed out like the brothers, like the criminal records of how many times they were arrested. Again, they didn't do much time at all. So I don't know, maybe in the, they definitely found their way through the legal system pretty well. But I mean, they got picked up all the time. Whereas I feel like you didn't see that as much in the North End. I think that some of the criminal figures of the North End were probably smart too. You know what I mean? They probably had other people doing their bidding. You know what I mean?
Well,
and
that,
not just out on the streets getting into fights and everything. You know what I mean?
And so. And they did bring a structure from Sicily, the mafia. They brought a structure with a leadership plan and and discipline, and internal set of rules that in which they disciplined people, and they understood the need to stay on the low, on the down low, and keep a low profile to keep the law enforcement and the government off of them. So whereas the Irish did not bring that structure with them, the best of my knowledge.
Yes, you can say that again, that's for sure. You know, you're totally right. You know, and that's one thing, you know, I interviewed the grandson of one of the mob bosses in the North End, and, you know, he said that his grandfather said he was like a judge who, you know, decided, you know what I mean, like who would, people who had differences would come to him, you know what I mean? And he would settle the differences. And, you know, which I thought was kind of an elegant way of describing, you know, that role, you know, so.
But that was actually, I think, probably the case, wasn't it? They wouldn't, you know, if people had a difference, they wouldn't go to the police. They would go to the family. And they'd bring, you know, come before, you know, this whoever this person was that was of authority to see them, and they'd resolve the issues really internally without, you know, without dealing with the having the police involved.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. You know, then I think from that, you know, any type of illicit activity, of course, you know, whenever you're delving into illicit activity, the last thing you want, you know, even if you're a bookie who just got held up, the last thing you want is you're not going to call the cops.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so, I mean, I think that strikes at the root of the organized crime in a way.
That's why that's why robbing drug dealers today is a kind of a lucrative activity for young mob guys.
Right. A lot of things have changed, but some things
some things don't.
Some things have stayed the same.
None of the Irish guys from the South Side going up in the Olympics boxing lately.
I know, right? Yeah. No, not,
I mean,
that
would seem to be
of,
the kind of position if you're going to run a gang. That's pretty. People already know who you are. Even if you only sat on the bench at the Olympics.
Yeah. It's really true. I mean, and that's where Steve Gustin, the whole Gustin gang name, there was a social club in Boston called the Gustin Social Club. The Wallace family, you know, was involved in it, you know, back when, of course, when, you know, there was no TV and everything, you know, the social club played a huge role in, like, you know, organizing, like, fundraisers, organizing, like, dances and, you know, just things for people to do. And when Steve Gustin started his boxing career, he instead of calling himself Stevie Wallace, he's like, I'm Stevie Gustin, you know. And then when he came back, started getting in the trouble, thereby all of the Gustin gang was born. But yeah, you're right. A lot of it, I mean, Sam Lindenbaum, there's actually quite a few guys who were boxers. And then, you know, kind of transitioned into a life of crime from boxing.
I wonder if any of them ever boxed Primo Canera.
Yeah, we did.
I know, right?
We did a story on this guy named Primo Canera, who was he was Italian, and he was a monster. He was like 6'7", 6'8", and about 300 pounds of muscle. They brought him. He came over to the United States and started boxing. And an Irish gangster in New York City named Oney Madden took him over and got a contract with him and managed him and then fixed a whole bunch of fights because this guy really couldn't punch his way out of a wet paper bag, and he had a glass jaw. But he was but everybody wanted to come and see Primo Canera. You talk to any middle-aged guy today who was a kid during the 50s and late 40s, he will remember that name, Primo Canera.
Yeah, without a doubt. I've seen his name pop up a zillion times.
See? Oh, I don't know what it is. It's a cool name, I guess.
Yeah, seriously. It's got a ring to it, you know?
Yeah, it does. It's like if you're going to be a baseball player, you got to be Mickey Mantle, you know? You need that cool name, Jesse James, if you're going to be a train robber, a bank robber.
Whitey Bulger. Yep.
Whitey Bulger. That's a good mob name.
It's got a ring to it.
It's got a ring to it.
You're either going to be like a gangster or a porn star.
Right.
Our underboss here was Tuffy DeLuna. Now, that's a good gangster name, Tuffy DeLuna.
Yeah, that is a good one.
Here was a kind of a question. Somebody that I know here in town who's related to Tuffy DeLuna, the nephew of Tuffy, would say, you know, they never did any good stories about all the things that the mob did that was helpful in the community. You ever write any stories like that?
Oh, about the good things?
Yeah. Did you ever run across where they'd given a lot of money to, we had one guest that said, well, they used to give money quietly to something called the St. Joseph's Table, which is some kind of
a Catholic service.
Catholic service and big feast every once a year. So did you ever run across anything like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's, one of the ones that stuck out to me, there's a lot of examples of mobsters being philanthropic, in this area. Doc Sagansky, again, one of the biggest bookmakers, in the country, he established a fellowship at Brandeis University in his name. It's no longer there because the funds were not endowed. But during the 60s, the Sagansky Fellowship definitely helped students, grad students, I believe, get through school. That's just one example. That I included in the book. I was hoping it was still around when I called up Brandeis, but unfortunately, the Sagansky Fellowship is no more. But I think there was another major figure from Revere who had a community center named after him, I believe. There's quite a few, a lot of the reputed mobsters and everybody in this area, had good streaks. I mean, a lot of them. I can't speak for all, that's for sure. There's also a lot of crazy ones, too.
So today, it sounds like you're like most of the other cities. New York is still kind of strong, nothing like they used to be. Kansas City has been decimated. Chicago is a mere shadow of its former self. Milwaukee is non-existent. Cleveland is a mere shadow of its former self, if not non-existent. So I think you said that it was at the Angelo family was kind of the main family in more modern times. Has that morphed into anything? Is there still actually what would be recognized as the La Cosa Nostra family?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely not as visible, nowhere near as visible as, they once were. Organized crime in general, there was a time when you could walk into a bar and actually, you could recognize and see, different hitmen like organized people who are connected, sitting there. Those times are gone. Anything that's happening is well underground, and I think it's safe to say it can't compare to the past. I mean, one thing that always comes up, one of the huge, it's funny how like the notion of organized crime also changes with time. I mean, one of the huge things, that funded a lot of organized crime was gambling. Before we had a state-run lottery, and there were number pools, and not that there's still betting going on, of course there is, But now that we have a state-run lottery, that took a huge chunk out of the business, so to speak. And the government runs gigantic operation of like scratch tickets and lotteries. And
plus, you probably got several casinos with an easy driving distance of metropolitan central Boston, and that's what happened here. Is we got four casinos in the area, but the one thing they did maintain, because you can't make a sports bet outside of Las Vegas, they still have a sports book. So I would have bet you still have a sports book there in Boston.
Yeah. No. I'm not saying that doesn't go on. You know what I mean? But I just think the size of it, from the records that I've seen, of it in the 50s and everything. And again, I could be wrong. You know what I mean? But there just seems to be a lot more opportunities, you know what I mean, for people to gamble elsewhere. So
yeah.
I think it's, kind of taking a bite out of it. The locations that I pointed out in my book and the map that I made, I'm like, there's a lot of history kind of like hidden underneath the surface. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's where, I hope people will get a kick out of, reading the book, and, they may even recognize some places that they didn't even think twice about, and then like, oh, wow, so-and-so was there, or like that happened there. Like, no kidding.
Yeah.
That's
what I like to do in my app. But lots of times there won't even be anything there. I say you have to use your imagination, but just imagine right here where this Quick Trip is, this convenience store is. There was once a little tavern called The Last Chance, and half of it sat in Kansas and half of it sat in Missouri. And when the cops would come to raid from Missouri, they'd shove all the gaming tables over to Kansas and vice versa. So you just have to use your imagination. But, people drive by that all the time, going back and forth to work. It's a long kind of a commuter route that's off the highway, and they don't have any idea. So, yeah, I understand what you're talking about, to make people aware of what they're seeing. There's more to what they're seeing than what they're seeing.
Well, if people go over to your website, which is bostonorganizedcrime.com, you've got stories that you've written and posted up there, as well as leads and links to your books.
So basically I have links to the books. I got links to the map that I made, and links to some photos and documents. And also the Facebook page is where I've kind of made that my more of a repository recently for photos. I've been including more photos of the places that are in the book for people to check out. So it's definitely worth checking out the Facebook page too. You're right. I need to put up links to the stories that I did for the Brookline tab and for the Globe. I'm not sure. I'm going to track those links down. A lot of them have changed.
Do you have a Twitter account at all?
Yeah. My Twitter handle is just my name, Emily Sweeney.
We definitely have to have folks that will share a link to BostonOrganizedCrime.com and your two books. One, the first one, published in 2012, Boston Organized Crime, and the one that just came out days ago, Gangland Boston, which carries the Boston mob and back to the 1890s. That's an incredible history there.
All right. Thanks a lot, Emily.
All right. Thank you, Gary.
Good night.
Take care, Aaron.
Thanks.
All right. Take care.
Thank you so much. And we got to remember to tell folks, you have to follow her. She's on Twitter at Emily Sweeney. And, of course, the Facebook for BostonOrganizedCrime.com is just Facebook.com/BostonOrganizedCrime. Give her a follow.
All right. That was great, Aaron. That was nice to get a different accent on here, too, in our ongoing series on media and the mob. Each reporter, this is a little bit younger reporter than the others we've had, so each reporter has their own style and their own things that they've done. But organized crime pretty much remains the same. Although, notice we didn't hear much about Irish mob in Chicago, and you'll hear nothing about any Irish mob in Kansas City and, of course, Las Vegas. I guess the farther you get back east, if you remember, we did the story on Oney Madden and on up to Jimmy Coonan. So it seems like it's an Eastern phenomenon, this Irish immigrants that formed organized crime groups and lasted on up into the 20th century.
I think the map that she's got, the Google map on her on her website, Boston Organized Crime. I've definitely got to check that out.
Yeah, I've got one on mine.
But you don't have one for Boston.
No, I don't have one for Boston.
You should put a link to her map in your app.
Yeah, I'll take a look at hers. Actually, I'm gonna help her figure out how to make a downloadable app that people can take their own mob tour on their phone rather than in their laptop. Because remember, she said that
works really well on a desktop. And yeah. You can't carry one of those around to do a walking tour.
But that app, you can go around and do the walking tour.
But she's still working for the Boston Globe.
She is.
She's not retired.
No, she's pretty busy. She's doing book signings and writing books and working for the Globe full time, and sounds like a couple other things. So she's a pretty interesting gal.
How did you come across her?
Just went to Boston. I started looking. I thought, well, I need some more mob reporters from back east. We got Anthony DiStefano, and we didn't really call Bulldog Drummond from Chicago a reporter. I mean, so I just started looking at the Boston Globe and Googling some different keywords, and I found her, and she had her books, and she'd been reporting on the crime and the mafia and organized gangs in Boston, so we got a hold of her, and she was happy to do it.
Reached out to her and said, hey, here's who I am and what I do. And
that's a good thing about newspaper reporters. They'll have a email at the end of each one of their stories because they want people to get hold of them and send them tips on stories.
I don't know if we have any tips for her at the moment.
Back east they do. Yeah. In Boston they probably do. Now, like Bulldog Drummond, he's a little harder to get hold of. I had to go through our friend Red Romette to find him because he's not actively working now. He's retired. A little harder to get hold of. But Red helped us out there. Thanks, Red.
Yeah, thank you, Red. We should talk to Red again sometime.
We are. We got those two FBI agents that are going to be calling in, I think, next week. And what else? Oh, I got Detroit. I got a Detroit reporter that we're going to do one with, too, another phoner. So, but we'll get Red back on here as soon as we can. I think it's time for a public service announcement. If you've got a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that?
I got to say, folks, if you enjoyed this episode, you're going to enjoy over 150 original Gangland Wire true crime story podcast episodes. What you want to do is subscribe to the iTunes, and every early Monday morning, you're going to get a notice direct from Gary with a brand new episode, just as good as this one, if not better. And then what you want to do is get the movie that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon. Then get the app that Gary developed and we talked about on this episode, Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then you're going to want to get the book that Gary just finished and released this year, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Literally, a book transcribing the words from the mouth of the men that did it. But then you're going to want to get the Kindle version, which has hyperlinks to video files that play back the actual wiretap audio with a transcription you can read while you listen to the words from the mouth of the men that did it.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Back in 1920, folks was acting kind of funny, and we couldn't even get us a drink. Except the rock up moonshine kind of make you go blind, mix right in the kitchen sink. Harder times, there was no denying, folks could only fritter and fry. But there was nothing you could do because you couldn't get no better than that. Then along came a man and you know he had the plan to get all of them good times back. You bring the good stuff down and pass the word around, you could bet your walls gonna get fat. And it turned out true, all you had to do was keep your eyes watching your back. That whiskey poured like gold, and you couldn't get no better than that.
and it didn't take him long till everywhere he roamed he got the red carpet welcome, man. Times roll, running them rumble miles, stacking the open piles, and the people on the line up for more. And them bulls in blue knew exactly what to do, just keep the cool and take on the pad. That whiskey weighed like gold, and you couldn't get no better than that. But it didn't take long between the money and the guns until you heard the shotgun crack. Sad but true, the hardest thing to do is just to make it to the end of the track. And for the chosen few, here's to how you do, just give them all a tip of the hand. It ain't the same these days, think it's safe to say, they just don't make them like that. So let the stories be told, because it never got no better than that. Here's to them days of old, you know it never got no better than that.